Unit 5, The Birth of Modern America, 1865 to 1900. Why it matters. Following the turmoil of the Civil War and Reconstruction, the United States began its transformation from a rural nation to an industrial urban nation. This change spurred the growth of cities, the development of big business, and the rise of new technologies such as the railroads. New social pressures, including increased immigration, unionization movements, and the populist movement in politics, characterized the period as well. Understanding this turbulent time will help you understand similar pressures that exist in your life today. Chapter 13. Settling the West, 1865 to 1900. Why it matters. After the Civil War, a dynamic period in American history opened, the settlement of the West. The lives of Western miners, farmers, and ranchers were often filled with great hardships, but the wave of American settlers continued. Railroads hastened this migration. During this period, many Native Americans lost their homelands and their way of life. The impact today. Developments of this period are still evident today. Native American reservations still exist in the United States. The myth of the Western hero is prominent in popular culture. Section 1. Miners and Ranchers. An American Story. Jacob Waldorf arrived in Virginia City, Nevada in 1873 to seek his fortune in the fabled silver mines of the Comstock Lode. Like many others, he found work at one of the big mining companies. 7 days a week he toiled in a dangerous mine shaft, earning enough to support his family and buy a little stock in local mining companies. As his son John recalled, "The favorite game with our father was stocks. Mother used to say to me, 'Someday we're going back east.' But for years, none of the stocks in which Dad invested showed any disposition to furnish us with the price of transportation." In 1877, the stock Waldorf owned skyrocketed in value. Dad's holdings rose to $10,000, and Mother began to talk of buying a farm, John wrote. The stock kept going upward. Dad was worth $15,000 for at least a minute. He waited for the stock to go even higher before selling, but instead it plummeted. The bottom fell out of Ophi, a mining stock, and Mother's dream farm fell with it, for Dad was broke. Jacob Waldorf overcame his financial setback. Earning the respect of his fellow workers, he headed the miners' union in 1880 and later served as a state legislator. Adapted from A Kid on the Comstock. Growth of the mining industry. The story of Western mining is bigger than the individual stories of fortune seekers like Waldorf. The West's rich deposits of gold, silver, and copper served the needs of growing industries in the East. It also brought the first wave of settlers that populated the mountain states of the West. News of a mineral strike in an area would start a stampede of prospectors desperately hoping to strike it rich. Early prospectors would extract the shallow deposits of ore largely by hand in a process called placer mining, using simple equipment like picks, shovels, and pans. After these surface deposits dwindled, corporations would move in to begin quartz mining, which dug deep beneath the surface. As those deposits dried up, commercial mining either disappeared or continued on a restricted basis. Economics. The Big Strike in Nevada. The story of the Comstock Lode is similar to other stories of gold, silver, and copper strikes throughout the West. In 1859, a prospector named Henry Comstock staked a claim in Six Mile Canyon, Nevada. The sticky blue-gray mud found there turned out to be nearly pure silver ore. News of the Comstock strike brought hordes of miners to Virginia City, Nevada. Almost overnight, the town went from a frontier outpost to a boom town of about 30,000, boasting an opera house, shops with furniture and fashions from Europe, several newspapers, and a six-story hotel with the West's first elevator called a rising room. When the silver veins were exhausted several years later, the mines closed. Without the mines, the town's economy collapsed, and most of the townspeople moved on in search of new opportunities. This cycle of boom and bust, from boom town to ghost town, was repeated throughout the mountainous West. During the booms, crime posed a serious problem. Prospectors fought over claims, and thieves haunted the streets and trails. Law enforcers were scarce, and self-appointed volunteers sometimes formed vigilance committees to track down and punish wrongdoers. In some cases, they punished the innocent or let the guilty go free. But most people in these communities respected the law and tried to deal firmly but fairly with those accused of crimes. Mining towns such as Virginia City at first were inhabited mostly by men, but soon they attracted more women. Some women owned property and were influential community leaders. Others worked as cooks or in laundries. Still other women worked at hurdy-gurdy houses, named after the mechanical musical instrument where they danced with men for the price of a drink. Other bonanzas. Mining also spurred the development of Colorado, the Dakota Territory, and Montana. The discovery of gold near Pike's Peak in 1858 set miners on a frantic rush. Coining the phrase, Pike's Peak or bust, many panned for gold without success and headed home, complaining of a Pike's Peak hoax. In truth, there was plenty of gold and silver in the Colorado Mountains, but much of it was hidden beneath the surface and hard to extract. One of the richest strikes occurred in the late 1870s in Leadville, so-called for deep deposits of lead that contained large amounts of silver. By the summer of 1879, as many as 1,000 newcomers per week were pouring into Leadville, creating one of the most legendary boom towns dotting the mining frontier. Overall, operations at Leadville and other mining towns in Colorado yielded more than $1 billion worth of silver and gold, many billions in today's money. This bonanza spurred the building of railroads through the Rocky Mountains and transformed Denver, the supply point for the mining areas, into the second largest city in the West after San Francisco. The discovery of gold in the Black Hills of the Dakota Territory and copper in Montana led to rapid development of the northern Great Plains. Miners flooded into the region in the 1870s. After railroads were built in the 1880s, many farmers and ranchers moved to the territory. In 1889, Congress divided the Dakota Territory and admitted North Dakota and South Dakota, as well as Montana, as new states. Reading check. Explain. How did the creation of new states change the political boundaries of the Great Plains? Ranching and cattle drives. While many Americans headed to the Rocky Mountains to mine gold and silver after the Civil War, others began building vast cattle ranches on the Great Plains. In the early 1800s, Americans did not think cattle ranches on the Great Plains were practical. Water was scarce, and cattle from the east could not survive on the tough prairie grasses. Farther south, however, in Texas, there existed a breed of cattle adapted to living on the Great Plains. The Texas Longhorn was a breed descended from Spanish cattle that had been brought to Mexico 2 centuries earlier. Ranchers in Mexico and Texas had allowed their cattle to run wild, and slowly a new breed, the Longhorn, had emerged. Lean and rangy, the Longhorn could easily survive in the harsh climate of the plains, and by 1865, as many as 5 million of them roamed the grasslands of Texas. Mexicans had introduced cattle ranching in New Mexico, California, and Texas before these areas became part of the United States. The industry grew in part because of the open range, a vast area of grassland owned by the government. The open range covered much of the Great Plains and provided land where ranchers could graze their herds free of charge and unrestricted by the boundaries of private farms. Mexican cowhands developed the tools and techniques for rounding up and driving cattle. These Hispanic herders taught American cowhands their trade and enriched the English vocabulary with words of Spanish origin, including lariat, lasso, and stampede. Before the Civil War, ranchers had little incentive to round up the longhorns. beef prices were low, and moving the cattle to eastern markets was not practical. Two developments changed this situation: the Civil War and the construction of the railroads. During the Civil War, eastern cattle were slaughtered in huge numbers to feed the armies of the Union and the Confederacy. After the war, beef prices soared, making it worthwhile to round up the Longhorns if a way could be found to move them east. By the 1860s, railroads had reached the Great Plains. Lines ended at Abilene and Dodge City in Kansas and at Sedalia in Missouri. Ranchers and livestock dealers realized that if the Longhorns were rounded up and driven north several hundred miles to the railroad, they could be sold for a huge profit and shipped east to market. In 1866, ranchers rounded up cattle and drove about 260,000 of them to Sedalia, Missouri. Although only a fraction of the herd survived this first long drive, the drive overall was a tremendous success, proving that cattle could be driven north to the rail lines and sold for 10 times the price they could get in Texas. Other trails soon opened. The route to Abilene, Kansas became the major route north. Between 1867 and 1871, cowboys drove nearly 1.5 million head of cattle up the Chisholm Trail to Abilene, a town that, when filled with cowboys at the end of a drive, rivaled the mining towns in terms of rowdiness. As the railroads expanded in the West, other trails reached from Texas to more towns in Kansas, Nebraska, Montana, and Wyoming. The Long Drive. A long drive was a spectacular sight. It began with the spring roundup, when ranchers met with their cowboys to collect cattle from the open range. Stock from many different owners made up these herds. Only their brands, showing which rancher owned the cattle, distinguished them from one another. Stray calves with no identifying symbols were called mavericks. These were divided and branded. The combined herds moving on to the trail could number anywhere from 2,000 to 5,000 cattle. Cowboys for major ranchers went north with the herds. Most of the cowboys in the early years of the cattle drives were former Confederate Army soldiers escaping the harsh life in the South during Reconstruction. A few were Hispanic, and many were African Americans such as Nat Love. Born an enslaved man in Tennessee in 1854, Love was freed at the end of the Civil War. He went west in 1869 and applied for work with a cattle driving outfit that included several other African American cowhands. After breakfast, I asked the camp boss for a job as a cowboy. He asked me if I could ride a wild horse. I said, "Yes, sir." He said, "If you can, I will give you a job." So he spoke to one of the colored cowboys called Bronco Jim and told him to go out and rope old Goodeye, saddle him, and put me on his back. Bronco Jim gave me a few pointers and told me to look out, for the horse was especially bad. This proved to be the worst horse to ride I had ever mounted in my life, but I stayed with him, and the cowboys were the most surprised outfit you ever saw, as they had taken me for a tenderfoot, pure and simple. After the horse got tired and I dismounted, the boss said he would give me a job and pay me $30 per month and more later on. Quoted in Life and Adventures of Nat Love. Life for Love and the other cowboys on the trail demanded discipline, endurance, and courage, but those who survived the many dangers collected wages to spend in the towns at the end of the trail. Life in these towns was exciting, but many cowboys told exaggerated tales of daring that often supplied material for what were called dime novels. These adventure books sold for a dime and helped spread the myths of the Wild West in eastern towns and cities. Ranching becomes big business. Cowboys drove millions of cattle north from Texas to Kansas and points beyond. Some of the cattle went straight to slaughterhouses, but many were sold to ranchers who were building up herds and grazing them in Wyoming, Montana, and other territories. When sheep herders moved their flocks onto the range and when farmers settled there, blocking the trails, range wars broke out among competing groups. Eventually, and after considerable loss of life, the range was largely fenced off with a new invention, barbed wire, which enabled hundreds of square miles to be fenced off cheaply and easily. At first, ranchers saw barbed wire as more of a threat than an opportunity. They did not want to abandon open grazing and complained when farmers put up barriers that prevented the ranchers' livestock from roaming. Soon, however, ranchers used barbed wire to shut out those competing with them for land and to keep their animals closer to sources of food and water. For cowhands, however, barbed wire ended the excitement of long cattle drives. The fencing in of the range was not the only reason the long drives ended. Investors from the East and from Britain poured money into the booming cattle business, causing an oversupply of animals on the market. Prices dropped dramatically in the mid-1880s, and many ranchers went bankrupt. Then, in the winter of 1886 to 1887, blizzards covered the ground with snow so deep that the cattle could not dig down to the grass. Temperatures fell to more than 40 degrees below zero. The cattle industry survived this terrible blow, but it was changed forever. The day of the open range had ended. From that point on, herds were raised on fenced-in ranches. New European breeds replaced longhorns, and the cowboy became a ranch hand. Reading check. Analyzing. How did heavy investment in the cattle industry affect the industry as a whole?